Hi, I'm Kate Archer-Kent on The Morning Show. Just a quick thank you to everyone who donated during our winter member drive. Support from people like Cassandra in Egg Harbor powers the variety, the depth, the lifelong learning you value on Wisconsin Public Radio. If you missed the drive, there's still time to join in with your gift at WPR.org. And listeners like you play a vital role in keeping Wisconsin informed and connected. Thank you for your important partnership. Now we're talking about community-supported agriculture programs and your experience with CSAs. Members support the farmer by paying a fee, usually in the winter or spring, that entitles you to a share of the season's harvest. And some farms have waiting lists. The USDA maintains a CSA directory, last updated Friday, listing dozens of CSA farms in our state. Do you subscribe to a CSA, or are you thinking about it? What do you think of getting food directly from a farmer? 800-642-1234 to join in. Stephen Spickerman and his spouse Landis have operated the 140-acre Hermit Creek Farm in Ashland County since 1989. They've offered CSA shares for nearly 30 years, have about 250 members. Stephen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. It's great to be here.
Good morning. Are you adequately snowed under yet? What do you see out there?
Well, we've probably gotten about 8 to 10 inches so far, and it's still coming down, so we'll see.
Well, I dare say you're not going anywhere fast. It's a good time to talk about CSAs.
Well, it's a great time to talk about CSA.
Give us a little tour, if you will, of Hermit Creek and your certified organic farm. What are you growing?
Sure. Well, we like to call ourselves a full-scale market farm. We grow pretty much everything you can grow anywhere in Wisconsin. We grow both outdoors in the field as well as in 9 high tunnels and a heated greenhouse. We also raise pastured pork and grass-fed lamb and have a small apple orchard.
And tell us about the CSA component. How do CSAs work and how do they fit into your business model?
Sure. Well, we've been a CSA for nearly 30 years, which makes us one of the longer tenured CSAs in the Midwest. And CSA is really how we started our farm. We had started growing vegetables for a home, you know, just basically for home. That spun out of control, and we looked for a place to put our excess vegetables. And at about the same time, CSAs were beginning to take hold in the upper Midwest in the late 80s, early 90s. And we thought that looked like a really great model for us to connect with our community. So we started small. We started with 8 or 9 shares, and we still have a couple of those original members with us all these years later. Great. Big shout out to them. They know who they are, and they're quite probably listening this morning.
CSA.
As I say, we just kind of.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go
ahead.
I was going to jump in and just say that participation, that person's personal engagement, I would imagine, goes beyond a standard business to consumer relationship. This is not purely transactional. Is that right?
That's. Totally correct. We like to call it food with a face. Typically, you go into a grocery store, you buy your food, you have no idea where it comes from, who grew it. With CSA, you have a very direct connection with where your food comes from. Our CSA members can come to the farm. We meet them at our drop sites. We know about their lives. They know about our lives. Oftentimes, those CSA members are members for decades, years and decades. And So it's a very direct connection. And when the farm has a great year, our CSA customers have a great year. And luckily, more often than not, we have really great years. So it's really about community and about connection.
We're talking with Stephen Spickerman, who's co-owner of Hermit Creek Farm in High Bridge in northwest Wisconsin. You can join in. Do you subscribe to a farm share program or a CSA? What do you like about getting your food directly from farmers? What do you want to learn more about if you think you want to establish a CSA? 800-642-1234. So members, as you said, there share the risks, the responsibilities. They share in the good harvest, the not so good harvest. Can you elaborate there on the risks and the responsibilities?
Sure. You know, typically a farm takes 100% of the risk. You put crops in the ground, and if you don't have a good year, you don't have anything to sell. With CSA, you typically pay up front. So right now is we're in our heaviest CSA sign-up period. So that money is coming in right now without any crops in the ground, which of course puts a bit of a stress on us as farmers, but part of being a good farmer is knowing that we'll come through. But what it does is it gives us the seed money to get our season going, to know that we can hire employees, that we can buy all the crop inputs that we need ahead of time. And so that's the risk that our members are joining in. They're kind of taking each person a little piece of that pie, and it takes a little bit of stress off of the farmer. And then as the season progresses, you know, we give back those crops. And what we typically shoot for is to fully meet what folks paid for and then some. And typically we, because we are a long tenured farm, we've got systems in place. We don't have a lot of problems, but we could have a year like last year where we had a drought and some crops did great, but other crops didn't do so well. We typically grow a lot of bell peppers. Bell peppers were in short supply last year. In fact, we also do some wholesale. Typically, we'll be wholesaling bell peppers. We didn't wholesale bell peppers last year. They all went to our CSA, which is our first outlet.
Oh, that's interesting. CSA being your first priority, and that, you know, you get the money from your shareholders before harvest. Literally, it is seed money. Does that help with carrying over or lowering financial debts or with the financial management of the farm?
It definitely helps. I mean, a typical farm will oftentimes have to take out loans at this time of year in order to purchase their inputs. And in essence, we're taking out a loan from the folks who join our farm. So we're not, you know, in our payback of that debt is in the form of vegetables or pork or lamb, whatever folks happen to purchase. And so it takes a huge amount of stress off of the farmer. It adds some other stresses, like, you know, if you go into the year not knowing you're going to have a great year. But each successive year that we're in business as a farm, we feel just that much more confident in our abilities to come through with what we grow.
It's also interesting that you're able to freely set the price of your share, of your CSA share, and you identify what you consider to be fair value for the work you do. And I'm wondering, you know, that's a really interesting model. It gives you a lot more a power, if you will, of, you know, predicting your future. What do you make of that?
I think that's a pretty accurate statement. The way we personally set our share prices is we look at what our wholesale prices are, and we use that somewhat as a benchmark. We don't want to shock people with the price of food. Wholesale prices are what they are, and they're pretty steady. So we'll use that wholesale price as a benchmark. We'll add on what we need to add on to get the share to people. And so reality is people are getting product at probably under retail cost. We obviously have competition. There are other CSAs that service our area. And so I think all the CSAs in a given area look at what other CSAs are doing, and we try to keep our share prices somewhat similar, so that, you know, part of it is being able to sell those shares, and people will oftentimes shop for the lowest price. So you can't ask for too much.
We have a longtime CSA farmer in Ashland County. Stephen Spickerman is here explaining the role of community-supported agriculture in our food system. Does your food share box force you to get creative with your cooking, or do you end up throwing some unusual veggies away? Are you a farmer? How has the food share model worked for you? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up in a moment with Stephen Spickerman here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about farmers adopting the CSA business model and hearing your stories of community-supported agriculture on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In a traditional CSA model, members share the risks and benefits of food production with the farmer. Nearly a year ago, the food website Eater asked the question, is the pandemic CSA boom here to stay? What do you think? 800-642-1234. We have longtime farmer Stephen Spickerman of Hermit Creek Farm near Lake Superior South Shore with us for about five more minutes. Stephen, did you see a surge in membership in these pandemic times? What impact has the pandemic had?
You know, as far as membership, we saw a small increase in predominantly with our meat shares. We've held pretty steady with our share types. And so I don't think the pandemic necessarily gave us a huge boost as far as people suddenly looking for food. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the pandemic certainly, like most businesses, threw a monkey wrench at us with having to come up with protocols for how we delivered shares, for how our employees interacted on the farm when we were in enclosed spaces. 2020 was a really tough year as far as supply chain. I think it caught a lot of people off guard, and suddenly seeds were hard to get, which I think caught a lot of farmers unaware. This year hasn't been quite as troubling as far as supply chain goes. So, you know, I think it, like most businesses, it threw a monkey wrench at us, and it just meant we had to do some homework and learn how to live with things.
And on top of that, you also have to do a tricky timing thing as you produce food to distribute to members. How difficult is it to manage that production to make sure you have enough food for those boxes?
Well, that's where my wonderful wife, Landis, comes in. She's a a super organized planner. In effect, she is the farmer on our farm. I work for her. And her forte is really planning. And so we have it down by the day what needs to get planted in our greenhouse. We do a lot of transplanting. So we grow those transplants out in a heated greenhouse. We've already actually started that. Virtually every day has something getting planted, and then those go into the field at the correct time, giving us a harvest at the correct time, so that we always have at least 8 to 12 items ready to harvest on any given day for our CSA shares. It's really it's an orchestrated dance.
Wow. Timing is everything. What would be in your winter share? I'm really curious. December to March, what are you putting in there?
Well, that's mostly storage crops.
Okay.
So potatoes, onions, winter squash, beets. Think of carrots. We do a lot of carrots. But we also, because we have high tunnels, we grow kale that we harvest in December and sometimes even as late as January, depending on the year. And right now we're growing microgreens for our upcoming March delivery.
Hmm.
So it's storage crops plus a little bit of extra that we can squeeze in.
Your CSA is so well established, and I would imagine it means that you have these long relationships with your shareholders. But do other newer CSAs have challenges with member turnover or low member retention? What is that like?
You know, that's probably the biggest issue with CSA is member retention. And a new CSA is probably going to struggle simply because of the planning and timing. And there are various reasons why people leave CSAs. The number one reason that we get for people leaving our CSA is that we give them too much food, which seems like an odd reason to leave. But I would guess that the reasons why folks leave CSAs, you know, there's probably a myriad of reasons. It is tough to start a CSA. Years ago, we had a well-known, long-tenured CSA grower stop by our farm, Linda Halley, and she told us that to be a CSA farmer is sort of like the PhD of farming. And it's unfortunately probably a lot of young new farmers start right away with a CSA because it is a great model. The reality is it's also a very tough model, a very tough way to farm as far as stresses and having everything ready to go at the exact right time and meeting the expectations of your customers. So, I mean, we're lucky that we've done it a long time. We had some very dedicated eaters early on, many of whom have stayed with us for all these years. And right now, our retention rate's probably in the 83 to 85% range, year in and year out, which is, it is really great for us as far as knowing what we're going to be doing on any given year.
It helps make it more predictable. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. I really appreciated being on, and I always enjoy your show, Kate.
Oh, thank you. Take care. Stephen Spickerman and his wife Landis have operated the 140-acre Hermit Creek Farm in northwest Wisconsin since 1989, offered CSA shares since 93, and have about 250 members. Now, the U.S. women's ice hockey team claimed the silver medal last week, falling to Canada in a hard-fought final game. But as Diane Bazooka reports, their success over the years is already sparking changes in girls' hockey and inspiring the next generation of players.
When women's ice hockey was added to the Olympics in 1998, Alex Cavallini was 6 years old and just learning how to skate. Her mom, Nancy Rigsby, remembers what Alex said when Team USA won gold.
She goes, "I'm going to go to the Olympics someday."
20 years later, she was the backup goaltender for Team USA at the 2018 Games in Pyeongchang. She returned this year to Beijing, and now she has two Olympic medals. But Cavallini's path to the apex of women's ice hockey wasn't easy.
There weren't as many quality girls clubs as there are now. So she never played girls hockey really other than a few tournament teams until she went to college.
Like many of her teammates, Cavallini grew up playing on boys teams because it was the only option. Now more than 800 girls on 28 teams play high school hockey in Wisconsin. When the state's girls hockey program started in 2002, there were just 6 teams. Tom Shafransky is an assistant director of the state's High School Athletic Association.
Now we're starting to see where moms are able to say, hey, you know, I played for this team and it was a great thing for me, and their daughters are the ones who are now coming forward. And we certainly see an uptick whenever the Olympics come around and the girls' Olympic program does well, especially when they win gold.
And those high school players are going on to college. This season, the NCAA expanded the Division I college women's hockey tournament from 8 to 11 teams and added several new Division III programs. The Women's Professional Hockey League is also adding teams. Carla Pendmon played for Wisconsin from 2009 to 2011. Now, she helps high school players navigate the college recruitment process.
And I have young girls who want to play hockey at Wisconsin or Minnesota, and they wear those sweatshirts. And I think being able to look at those teams that have had so much success and see what can be, and the beautiful locker rooms and the amenities, and even taking jets to play teams, you know, as females, it's just so cool.
But for the youngest girls who want to play hockey, boys teams are often still the only option. When 13-year-old Jessie DeMarcy started playing hockey, she played on a boys' team near Janesville.
One time I had to change in a closet with two other girls. I wouldn't really talk unless there was another girl on the team.
Now she plays goalie for a girls' team in Verona. It's a longer drive to practice, but Jessie says she feels more included. That's why Robin Billsborough with the Wisconsin Amateur Hockey Association created all-girls teams for the youngest players, ages 8 and under. When she started with the association, girls made up only 13% of the players in her region. 5 years later, that number has grown to 33%.
Part of youth sports is that team environment. It's not just all about being a great athlete. It's all about the connections and the team camaraderie.
Hockey mom and former college player Amanda Ferwerda agrees. The real impact of an all-girls team is in the locker room.
Building those relationships and getting yourself set and comfortable for the game. You can't do that in a small closet, getting ready by yourself. Representation matters, and being with people that are like you matters.
At a Saturday practice in Middleton, 9-year-old Nora Martin is getting ready to take the ice. She's one girl who still plays with the boys, and she calls the U.S. women's team players her hockey heroes.
It's amazing to see them like be able to play and know that they had to go through stuff to get to where they are right now, and to see that they're in the Olympics, to see that they're on TV, just to see that they're playing is like amazing to watch.
Her favorite player is former UW Badger Brianna Decker, who also grew up playing on boys' teams in Wisconsin. Diane DeZuka, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Ahead this hour, we check in with the commander of the Wisconsin National Guard. Major General Paul Knapp is here to discuss recent missions. What questions do you have about the role of the National Guard in these times? Join in 800-642-1234. News update is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You are with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Join WPR today at 1:15 for live coverage of the 2022 State of the Tribes Address from the Assembly Chambers in the State Capitol. This year's address will be delivered by President Shannon Holsey of the Stockbridge-Munsee Band of the Mohican Nation. That's the 2022 State of the Tribes Address today at about 1:15 on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. Now to Wisconsin National Guard missions. In its year in review, it called 2021 one of the most historic years in Wisconsin National Guard history. The Guard's COVID response focused on testing and vaccine distribution. In recent weeks, dozens of Guard members have trained up as nursing assistants to help alleviate staffing crunches in hospitals and nursing homes. Are you a member of the National Guard? Share your experience. Have you seen troops working at hospitals or as poll workers? Join in 800-642-1234. The Wisconsin National Guard's Adjutant General, Major General Paul Knapp, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Morning, Kate. So great to be on with you and talk to your listeners about all the great things going on with the Department of Military Affairs in Wisconsin.
Well, you were there a week ago hearing Governor Evers in a State of the State say the words, the longest Guard activation in Wisconsin state history. Can you make those words come to life for us? Give us a sense of what this longest activation feels like, what it means.
Wow, it has encompassed so many things over the last 2 years since the start of COVID. Everything from doing COVID testing, COVID vaccines. We assisted with the polling places. And actually, if I take you back to the very beginning of the pandemic, we assisted the cruise ship passengers as they returned from Wisconsin.
That's right. I remember.
From California. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's been one thing after another. And almost all of these things, the commonality between them is that they're things that we're asking our service members to do that they really hadn't trained for in the past.
You surely know the numbers by heart, but Guard members have administered well over a million COVID tests around the state since the start. And now with the federal government sending people at-home tests, do you think the pandemic role of the Guard will change this year?
I do, and I hope it does. Primarily, I'm hoping that we go into the next phase of the pandemic as it tapers off. You know, I think we're all hoping for the same thing. And we definitely, you know, we're the first military responder in domestic events here in Wisconsin. But at the same time, what we are hoping for is that we can get back to what we consider normal, and all of the positions and jobs and roles that we're filling now can be transferred back to the civilian community.
We've seen dozens of Wisconsin Guard members trained up to be CNAs recently, filling in at hospitals and nursing homes. Other states' Guard members have been called up to be substitute teachers and child care workers. Do you see an evolution of what constitutes a mission?
Absolutely. We're definitely beyond the paradigm that we had thought of in the past in terms of roles of the National Guard. That being said, we are the first military responder here in the state of Wisconsin. And at the end of the day, it's neighbors helping neighbors, and we'll do whatever it takes to keep the people of Wisconsin safe.
here we are in the great resignation, the great reshuffle, if you will. Do you see a declining number of soldiers in National Guard ranks? Is it more difficult to recruit?
Actually, we have done very well with retention and recruiting throughout the pandemic. Events like this, if you go back to 9/11, after 9/11, recruiting actually went up across the military services. And we're seeing something about the same. It's not going up at the same rate, but it isn't going down. And I think folks considering joining the Wisconsin National Guard or those who are already in just really want to be a part of something bigger than themselves. And helping the state with the pandemic has been a great experience for most of the soldiers and airmen involved. In fact, many of them are the new and younger soldiers who've never deployed are having the opportunity to actually deploy in their home state, helping their friends and neighbors. That's unusual. Most of the time over the last 20 years, soldiers and airmen would train and then they would be training and preparing to force project overseas and would go and deploy in their role overseas. And that would be their deployment in service to this country. And to have the opportunity to do it here in the state, and they've been such a visible presence over the last 2 years, it really hasn't negatively impacted our recruiting or retention.
Can you take stock for us? How many of your soldiers remain mobilized now, and what are their missions at present?
Definitely. It's just over 600 right now, all in a voluntary status. We've been very careful probably for the last year to make sure that we are not impacting the soldiers and airmen's lives as much as possible. Of course, the COVID pandemic and the response is impacting all of our lives. And the primary missions that they're doing right now, we're still doing testing, COVID testing. We're still doing COVID vaccines on a smaller scale. And then we have over 200 right now in the certified nursing assistant role.
Over 200, you said?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yes, we're up to about 300 total that are directly supporting the healthcare efforts in the state of Wisconsin. It's awesome. You mentioned the CNA program. I can't thank the Department of Health Services and Madison College enough for facilitating the training of our soldiers and airmen to get that certified nursing assistant credential. Not only is it helping them out in the field, we've opened up, this has allowed Wisconsin to open up hundreds more beds, primarily in long-term care, but also in hospital environments as well, for that wouldn't have been open based on the staffing shortages in the healthcare industry. But that certification that they can take with them after this mobilization for the pandemic is over is critical. We're also giving them a great exposure to the medical field. And I've been out in the field talking to the soldiers and airmen out there, and a number of them are considering it as a career in their civilian life going forward.
Has it been mainly hospitals that you are helping to staff, or is it mainly nursing homes? What is the setting that you're able to deploy these soldiers after they get that nursing assistant training?
Well, it's really across the board. We're split between state hospitals, mental health hospitals, the hospitals themselves, and then also long-term care. If I had to say, the level of effort is probably a little bit heavier in the long-term care. What that's allowed is to open those beds so that folks who need the long-term care, the nursing home facilities, can actually then return there or go there after a bout with COVID in the hospital. And it's helping free up beds in the hospitals as well.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Major General Paul Knapp, commands the Wisconsin National Guard. You can join in should National Guard troops fill essential jobs opening during a labor shortage. Join us with how you have seen the National Guard in your community, maybe in your local hospital. 800-642-1234. Governor Evers in the State of the State said he's investing $5 million of the state's federal COVID relief money into the Guard's comprehensive wellness office to boost mental and physical health care.
These folks have stepped up to serve our state time and time again during one of the direst periods of our state's history. and their service has not come without a cost, emotionally, physically, and mentally.
So how will the wellness office divide up the funding?
Well, we're working through the details right now, but I can't tell you how excited we are to have this money available to dedicate it to the wellness of the force. When asked, and people ask me quite often, what keeps me up at night? And really, that's the thing that keeps me up at night. You touched on it in your opening, unprecedented levels of mobilization in the state of Wisconsin. And it has taken a toll on our force. While it hasn't directly impacted recruiting or retention, it's super important to be able to take care of our soldiers and airmen across the board. So the first thing that we're doing is we're hiring more people. We're hiring right now, it's 6 to 10 new position descriptions that we're getting out there. And that's going to help us with the comprehensive health and wellness program. And just to give you a little bit on that, it was developed in Wisconsin in 2017. It's being benchmarked across the National Guard, in particular at the National Guard Bureau. And it was developed by CW3 Aaron Hunnell. I have to give him a shout out. Great individual and just super dynamic. And we wouldn't have this focus through the Comprehensive Health and Wellness Program without him. But it focuses on five pillars: the physical, mental, spiritual, social, and financial pillars of our lives, and the need to keep them in balance. And one of the things I have struggled with, or that we struggle with in the military, is to get people to fess up, to admit that they need help in one of those areas. Hmm. And this program really focuses on getting education in all those areas, and then also educating everyone on where to go, and then having those resources available to help the soldiers and airmen in the five different pillars.
Sounds like this wellness office will become kind of that one-stop resource office, if you will, to support these soldiers.
Absolutely. I talk a lot about the balance that a National Guardsman needs to take between their civilian career, military career, and personal life. Those three things, the triad or the three-legged stool. But really, the core or the foundation that helps us keep those three things in balance is this overall wellness. Very excited. It'll be a one-stop shop. In the past, we've only been able to offer this two-week course to a small number of soldiers and airmen. And what we're going to be able to do now is we're going to be able to open it up. Eventually, everyone will have access to the program over the course of a 2 or 3 year period. And in addition to the leaders, so there's a basic course, a leaders course, which is 5 days. And then CW3 Hunnell is going to be testing out a new executive leader course. I'll be one of the test subjects in that class coming up. I'll be a guinea pig, and the idea is he's going to be presenting it out in DC at the National Guard Bureau for adoption nationwide.
Discussing the role of the National Guard in these times with Major General Paul Knapp, commands the Wisconsin National Guard, made up of about 7,700 soldiers. Are you in the Guard? What questions do you have about service? When was your last deployment, and where did you go? What questions do you have for the commander? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Major General Knapp here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Governor Evers, the commander-in-chief of the Wisconsin National Guard, announced last week that the Guard has completed an assessment of its sexual assault and harassment prevention and response programs, closing out a 32-month process. In March 2019, U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin and Governor Evers called for an assessment of the Guard's sexual assault protocols following whistleblower complaints about incidents dating back to 2009. Do you think the National Guard is doing enough to handle sexual assault cases? How do you feel about the Guard assisting in pandemic-related missions and filling workforce gaps? 800-642-1234. Major General Paul Knapp, commander of the Wisconsin National Guard, with us for about 9 more minutes. I want to talk about those implementing the new recommendations to improve reporting protocols on sexual assault, sexual harassment. As this case closes, what have you learned?
Well, the big thing, Kate, is that it's an ongoing process. We've learned a ton, and we've also improved even more in the state of Wisconsin. A couple of big things of note that are kind of foundational are that we've made sure that we're completely in compliance with all federal and state guidelines on how we deal with sexual assault. That's number one in terms of compliance. Number one in terms of people is taking care of the victims. I think that if we focus on that as our number one priority and then have that foundation of great processes and procedures, we're going to have a world-class program. And that's the direction that we're headed. Another thing I want to mention that has been subject to a lot of controversy is how the Wisconsin National Guard investigates sexual assault. And just for clarification, there have been cases in our past where the Guard has done those investigations. However, we do not investigate sexual assault. The lead investigator for National Guard sexual assault cases is local law enforcement. We refer all cases to local law enforcement. And then if for some reason they decide not to investigate or that there isn't enough evidence perhaps to investigate, then we refer those cases back to the Office of Complex Investigations, which is an administrative investigative group out of the National Guard Bureau in DC. And then they would evaluate it from their perspective. Either way, the allegations are being investigated and it is outside of the influence of the Wisconsin National Guard.
And I want to just bear emphasis there on referring all allegations to local authorities. And when you mean all, that you mean every single one that comes in is referred to local authorities. Is that right?
Absolutely. Every single unrestricted report, that's where someone has come forward with an allegation of sexual assault, is referred to local law enforcement.
What has it been like to strengthen the support systems around victims, around people who are going through this process? What have you done there?
Well, the number one thing is, and my number one priority since the day that I got in this chair, as it relates to sexual assault and harassment, is to create an environment where everyone in the organization feels comfortable and protected in coming forward to report sexual assault, harassment, or frankly, any type of misconduct. That's the key, is they need to be able to come forward, trust the organization, that there won't be any reprisal, retaliation, and that we will take care of them. And that has been my number one priority. I feel like we're making great strides in that area, but it's an ongoing effort. We have to continue to get that message out. And the best way to get the message out and to change that is through our actions. And our actions are proving that out as we go. We have had an increase in the number of sexual assault allegations over the past couple of years since 2020. And that was expected. When I interviewed with Governor Evers, we discussed that. I said, if we do this right, we will get more allegations. Hopefully, and the goal is to have less of the problem in the first place, but there's always more out there than we know about. And the goal is to get all of those things out there, out in the open, so that we can help solve them and at the end of the day, take care of the victims.
Well, with this case, this investigation closed, what more needs to be done to prevent sexual assault and harassment in the National Guard? What does that future look like?
Well, the future looks like making training about sexual assault and harassment and the prevention of it and the fact that we just don't tolerate it has no place in the Wisconsin National Guard part of our day-to-day life. It's not a once a year annual training where we're filling a square. It comes out every month in our drill messages. It comes out from our commanders in small groups down at the unit level. In so many things, Kate, the key is to have those first line supervisors, the people that are working with the soldiers and airmen every single day, be familiar with the procedures, be familiar with the process, and then have those soldiers be comfortable with those first line supervisors in order to discuss issues that might be going on, whether it's sexual assault or some other misconduct.
We're talking with Major General Paul Knapp, Wisconsin National Guard's Adjutant General, as we look at the missions and the work of the National Guard with your questions, 800-642-1234. Let's look overseas for a moment. A Guard member served the state, as you've said, the federal military overseas as well when called up. Guard members have been on the, mobilized in Eastern Europe for NATO as part of Operation Atlantic Resolve. How are tensions in Eastern Europe? I mean, you know, given the situation in Ukraine on the brink of war, President Biden sending thousands of U.S. troops to reinforce NATO allies in Eastern Europe, what are the implications there for Wisconsin National Guard members?
Well, there are implications for the Wisconsin National Guard, like all of the United States, with the conflicts that are occurring in the conflict that's occurring in Eastern Europe. And, my thoughts and prayers go out to all the folks over there. And hopefully we can solve this without bloodshed. That being said, we do have soldiers, as you mentioned, over in Eastern Europe, primarily Poland, Romania, and Lithuania. I am happy to report that we don't have any soldiers right now in Ukraine itself. We did up until recently, but they were pulled back with the rest of the unit that they're augmenting from the Florida National Guard to another country in Europe. So it does affect us. I can't speculate on how it's going to affect us as a National Guard. As of right now, we don't have any additional orders to provide more soldiers or airmen to that region.
The 107th Maintenance Company that you mentioned over in Poland, are they still on track to return home at the end of their year-long mission in the spring?
They are on track. However, they have been extended as of right now by about 2 weeks, okay. Not to directly participate in anything that's going on with the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, but to ensure an overlap between them and the unit that's replacing them. So in the past, it was okay if you'd have kind of a gap in support in that NATO mission, but we're being overly cautious and keeping them for a short amount of time to make sure that the next unit replacing them here in a month or so is there and in place and ready to support that NATO mission if need be.
In our few moments left, all members of the military required to be vaccinated against COVID unless they have a waiver. The Air Guard had to be vaccinated by December. What has it been like to carry out the mandate from our nation's defense secretary, Lloyd Austin?
Well, like many things in the military, we follow the orders of those appointed above us, and we have proceeded with the mandate as it's been directed from the Department of Defense. The AIR has done a great job in complying with that mandate, which was due in December. The Army has until June to meet that mandate as well. But I mean, frankly, the vast majority of the soldiers and airmen in the Wisconsin National Guard have voluntarily gotten vaccinated. Many have gotten vaccinated because of the mandate, and then there are a few that have put in requests for medical or religious accommodation.
And thank you so much for joining us on the Ideas Network.